Our next speaker is the Reverend John Curtis Raines. Dr. Raines is a professor of religion at Temple University in Philadelphia. He has been there since 1966. During his time there, Dr. Raines has been chair of the Department of Religion, president of the Interfaith Council on the Holocaust of Philadelphia, and host of the long-running Sunday morning show Dialogue on ABC in Philadelphia. He's an accomplished lecturer, author, Fulbright Senior Scholar. He is the recipient of numerous grants and awards. He received the Lindbach Award for Distinguished Teaching in 2006. He is the co-founder of the Center for Religious and Cross-Cultural Studies at Gajah Mada University in Indonesia, and he teaches regularly in Indonesia and Malaysia. As I mentioned earlier, as a young Methodist minister from Long Island, Dr. Raines became a freedom rider. He was one of the five who rode the bus from St. Louis to Little Rock, where he was arrested and jailed for his participation. He remained active in the civil rights movement as a voter registration worker in 1964 and 65, which also caused him to be arrested and jailed. And he refers to the civil rights movement of the 1960s as his second education. Let's welcome Dr. Raines.
Well, I'm glad to be here today. The last time I was in a room like this, a courtroom, I left the courtroom immediately following my being there to go to jail. So I hope that doesn't happen today. I've been asked to tell my story, and I'm willing to do that, partly because my story is not just my story, it's the story of America and the story of the struggle for freedom in America at a certain time, 50 years ago, when that freedom was gravely threatened. But that story continues, even today, because once again we find ourselves in a nation whose freedom is fundamentally threatened. 50 years ago, I got on a bus called freedom. When I end my remarks, I'm going to suggest that we need to get on a bus today, a bus called freedom. My story began in much the same way as the story of each of you also began. My journey into becoming me took start without my consent. I did not choose any more than any of you got to choose my family of origin. I was not consulted, just as you were not consulted, as to my race or gender. Like all of us, I was simply thrown into my existence. The first me was not an expression of the freedom of me being me. It was the arbitrariness of me being me. And so also for you and your unchosen beginning. Like all of us, I was thrown into my existence arbitrarily, thrust into a family I did not choose, into a nation I did not choose, into a time in history and circumstances of social class location I did not choose. Now, it is evident from those of you who are looking at me that I had the wisdom of foresight to get myself born white and male. Less evident is the fact that I was also born into a family of significant class privilege. When I could finally make out what was going on around me, I discovered that I was living in a house that had 5 fireplaces, 7 bathrooms, a live-in maid, and for the first 5 years of my life, I was tended to by a governess. Now, I didn't ask for all of that, but that's what I got. Back in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the late 1930s and the early 1940s, I was given, without my asking for it, the whole package of privilege. The private schools, the private summer camps, the private country clubs, the tennis lessons, the horseback riding lessons, the sailing lessons, yeah, the whole thing. Yes, that is where John Curtis Raines got his start, inside power and inside privilege. My first education, my first way of looking at the world, my first way of understanding the world that I was looking at was from top down, was from inside privilege and power. But no one back in those days, in institutions of authority, in churches, in schools, no one told us back then that ours was only one way of seeing the world, one way of seeing and being enjoyed by only a tiny minority. We were, some strange way, raised in significant ignorance. That was my first education. And that is why I needed a second education. An education that I would get without intending it or even wishing it. You see, I left St. Louis to go south some 50 years ago to help black folks get some of the public freedoms I already enjoyed. Not a very radical or radicalizing reason, a kind of a noblesse oblige. I got my second education that mostly white privileged boys like me never got and didn't even know enough to know they needed it. I'm an accidental adult in that sense. Inside the black community of the South 50 years ago, that community of the South, largely black, saved my life, both literally and figuratively. I got an education, a second education, I desperately needed, but did not at that time know I needed. Born privileged, confined to stupidity, in its way. The invitation to that second education arrived on my desk in May of 1961. It was a mimeograph letter from a guy named Jim Farmer and an outfit called Congress on Racial Equality. They were looking for someone to get on a bus. Back then, I hardly knew who Jim Farmer was or what CORE was. And I had graduated from one of the best liberal arts colleges in the United States. My Carleton College class of 1955, in the previous 4 years, I'm telling you the truth, in the previous 4 years, that class of 1955, there was not one class on race, not one lecture on race, not even one conversation on race. Race for us white privileged folks was not on our screen, and it wasn't put on our screen by those who were responsible for giving us our education. If you were there back then, in schools like that, you know I'm telling the truth. We were being prepared to take our place as citizens in the midst of the Cold War, preparing to be doctors or lawyers or financial investors, or, back then, married to such a one, if female. Well, I didn't know it back then, but the insufficiencies of my privileged education were about to be changed. Farmer paid my way here to St. Louis, and on July 10th, 1961, five of us, three blacks and two whites, got on a Trailways bus together and left from St. Louis and got off that bus together in Little Rock, Arkansas. Four of us went together into the White House, into the white waiting room in that Trailways bus station, and we sat down. We were arrested and charged with threatening a breach of the peace. We were, I think, quite properly arrested. We did intend to breach the peace, that unholy peace of legalized segregation. We wanted to and did challenge and break those laws that should never have been made laws in the first place. Now, Judge Quinn Glover, a white guy of class privilege, one of my own kind, now, he was on the other side of this. He was up there. I was down here. Judge Quinn Glover took us into his chambers before finding us guilty and sentencing us to 6 months in prison and a fine of $500. He told us that he knew the Supreme Court had already decided we had a right, as interstate travelers, to sit together as blacks and whites in that white waiting room. But then he said, and I quote, "I want you to know why I'm finding you guilty. Because if I don't, I won't get reelected. And the guy's running against me is worse on niggers," that's the word he used, "worse on niggers than I am." End quote. What a shock for this white guy. Back in Minneapolis, where I grew up, my father played golf with the leading judges of the city, with the mayor of the city, who lived just down the block from us. Law defended me and my kind. Law was my kind. But now I found myself in a place I had never been before, outside of power, and regarded by power as an enemy. And power had the power to punish me for that. And that power was called the law. My second education, an education in what life looked like and how life was lived when lived outside of privilege and outside of power, had begun. I was given the gift of a new and different way of seeing the world and of being and living in that world that I now saw differently. I was given a chance at a second time, a second way of being John Curtis Raines. The John Curtis Raines I was just then beginning to become. So thank you, St. Louis, sending me south 50 years ago. Thank you, Judge Glover, for teaching me things about the law I needed to learn. But especially thank you, all those courageous young and not so young black folks of the South who stood up for America by sitting down at the lunch counter, who went to prison, and by that act saved freedom in our land, who found a way and made a way where there was no way. And thank you, all those nameless ones who made history, even as now you are the forgotten ones of history. Now, that would have been the end of my story, except the civic leaders of Little Rock, fearing a bad reputation, leaned on Judge Glover, and he decided he should change his mind. So he reversed his decision and allowed us to continue on south as we headed towards Shreveport and even deeper danger that awaited us there. But as I left Little Rock behind, I remembered something that happened to me as I was just getting off the bus and looking out at that white mob. Most of that crowd of white folks wished us harm, thinking of someone like myself as a betrayer of the white race. But a white woman of some 30 years pushed through the mob and pressed something into my hand. I looked down and saw it was a St. Christopher's medal for Catholics, the saint who protects you on dangerous journeys. Not all white people in the South were against what we were trying to do. We got on finally to New Orleans, and I went back to Long Island, where I was just finishing my career as a preacher and going on into the academic world. And the Long Island Post, the big newspaper in Long Island, had published on its front page a full picture of me being arrested in Little Rock. So when I got back to Long Island, I was either famous or infamous, depending on which side you were on all this. Well, there was a group in Massapequa working for open housing, trying to get the housing open. And they invited me to come and give an opening address to an open meeting. They were having that meeting in the basement of a Lutheran church. And it was an open meeting, so people for working on integrating Massapequa and those who were against it were both in the room. This actually happened. There was a man sitting right here And I knew which side he was on because as I was finishing my remarks, the blood on his neck finally consumed his ears. And I finished, he jumped to his feet, pointed to the wall behind me and said, "Was that man or any of his disciples black?" Oh dear. I turned around and I looked at this picture. Now, maybe you, Tom, remember a picture of something like this. This was not a Jewish Jesus. This was Jesus who was clearly an Anglo-Saxon, brown, long brown hair down to here, blue eyes, straight nose, and Jesus kind of looking over his shoulder like this, you know, the Jesus who never disobeyed his mother, Jesus. it came to me. I said, no, Jesus and all his disciples were Jews. I thought the guy was going to have a heart attack because the place was closed to Jews as well as to blacks. Yes, sometimes you win a few. I would go south again in 1964 and then again in 1965. And once again, I need to name the names of the forgotten ones of history, one of whom literally saved my life. The idea of the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964 was to bring thousands of students, mostly from the North, mostly white, to join with SNCC workers in Mississippi to work on voter registration and to establish local freedom schools. I was assigned to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. By then I was married and had two small children. My wife, Bonnie, knowing the danger, nevertheless gave me permission to go. As before in Arkansas, the majority of white folks in Mississippi regarded us white protesters as betrayers of our own race. There were, however, a few exceptions. One was a music professor teaching at the local university who spoke with a thick German accent. One night he gathered perhaps 10 local white Mississippians who were in favor of our activity. We met in his living room, and because of the fear of local white retaliation, the windows were covered with blankets. I asked him, "Why are you doing this? The administration of your university is highly politicized, and if they find out, you could lose your job." The man, a white man of some 50 years or so, answered simply and directly and very powerfully. He said, "Why do I do this? Because I come from Auschwitz." It happened. It's the first time I met a survivor. The last time I would go south as a civil rights worker, and the time I nearly got killed, was in May of 1965. A black Baptist preacher by the name of Charlie Sherrod, who had been my fellow student with me at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, was leading a voter registration drive in Newton, the county seat of Baker County in southwest Georgia. In that county, in that time, the black population constituted a two-thirds majority. But in 1965, not one black was registered to vote. Sherrod phoned from Newton back to the seminary in New York because the black demonstrators were routinely getting beaten up by local white toughs. And the FBI and the northern news media would not come down the 50 miles from Albany, Georgia, to Newton because back then, white violence against blacks was not considered newsworthy. So Sherrod asked for some white guys to come and join the protest. I was one of two who did that. And sure enough, now the FBI came down the 50 miles and took their notes. And the Northern Press came down and took their pictures. Now here is one of those forgotten ones of history who became my teacher. We were marching together around the county courthouse where the voter registration office was located. Just in front of me was a black woman of some 40 years, with two of her children marching just in front of her. A white woman half her age came up and said, and I heard, "Bessie, you get out of that line or never come to work in my house again." Bessie stayed in that line. She lost her job. But a few months later, she got her vote. Such was the meaning of the vote back then, before the vote got swamped by money. Here's how my life was put at risk, and how a local black farmer, whose name I never learned, saved my life. I had rented a car to get from Albany to Newton, and a local black protester had an epileptic seizure and needed to be taken to the hospital up in Albany. They asked me if I would take him, and I said yes. But I didn't even get out of town before the cops arrested me for, they said, driving on the wrong side of the street. Oh, yeah. It was early evening, and I was arrested and thrown into the local jail. Usually the jail is in the basement of the county courthouse, and so is relatively safe. But not in Newton. Instead, the jail was an isolated, freestanding, squat building out behind the courthouse and shrouded in darkness. There were only bars, no glass in the windows. There was a black part of the jail and a white part of the jail. I was the only one in the white part. All the local Ku Klux Klan would have to do is pour gasoline through that window and throw in a match. And that would be the end of John Curtis Raines. But the local black community knew I was in danger, and they got a local black farmer, to put his farm up as collateral for my bail. The next morning, I was out. I went south to help others get their freedom, and they gave me back my life, together with a second education a privileged white boy from the North wasn't supposed to get, or, as many thought back then and perhaps even still think, didn't need to get. I did get what I needed. And I thank you for that. Thank you, South. Thank you, black community of protests. Thank you, St. Louis, that 50 years ago you sent me off on the most important journey of my life. But that was then, and this is now. There was a struggle for freedom going on back then, and we needed, as a nation, to get on a bus together and ride toward freedom. And we made some progress on that. But today the struggle for justice is a struggle against the vastly expanding inequality of income and of wealth that today assaults our nation and threatens our freedom. For working class and middle class Americans, the dream is turning into a nightmare of unemployment and underemployment, the nightmare of being underpaid and overworked, the nightmare of owing more to the bank than your house is worth. Wall Street may be back in the big bucks, but Main Street is running on empty. And most of this has been going on for 30 years now. In those years, that inequality has opened up a grand canyon right in the middle of the American dream. Here's how that happened. Successive administrations in Washington, both Republican and Democrat, while our factories closed, stood by while the working class way of life was dismantled and destroyed. Yes, they talked about new good jobs. First it was high technology, and then it was the dot-com economy, and now it's the new green economy. But those jobs weren't and aren't that many, and they don't pay that well. The jobs that did come were at the lower end of the service economy. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just telling you what you already know. Just telling the story of how it's been for the past 40 years. The jobs that did come were at the lower end of the service economy, clerks in Walmart and Home Depot, or aides in hospitals or assisted living homes. Meanwhile, the top 20% of income earners, that's me, that's most of you also, the top 20%, they were doing just fine. Ah, and the top 1%, oh, the top 1%, they were doing amazing, mysterious, wonderful things. They were busy stealing America. Here's how that story of stealing America gets reflected in economic statistics. Let's go back 30 years. In 1976, the percentage of total U.S. income going to the wealthiest 1% was 9%. Top 1%, 9%. 30 years later, 2006. Now that top 1% gets out of the whole national income, 24%, 24, from 9 to 24% in 30 years. That's a threefold increase in inequality in 30 years. How did that happen? This is how. In those 30 years, somewhere between a third and a half of the increase in the total national income went to that wealthiest 1%. Let me say that again. In those 30 years, somewhere between a third and a half of the income increase of the total national income went to the wealthiest 1%. Think about that. How many of us, for many of us, our income was stagnant even after adding a second paycheck, but for the top 1%, their income was exploding. When talking about inequality, we should also talk about wealth, because besides income, wealth includes the value of a house or houses, the value of stocks and bonds, the value of retirement income, retirement accounts, and so on. Wealth, in short, measures inequality more accurately than income alone. By the end of that 30 years between 1976 and 2006, the richest 1% of the U.S. households owned 33.8% of all the national wealth. That's more wealth to the top 1% than the combined wealth of 90% of Americans. That's a very, very dangerous situation for those of us interested in freedom. Here's what's crucial. Income is not just about money. Inequality is not just about money. Concentrated wealth translates into concentrated political clout. Big money is taking away from the rest of us the meaning of our vote. Big money is buying America. Many of you are lawyers. So let me ask this. Should it be legal to steal a country from its own people? Maybe the Supreme Court needs to hear something from us. That's not the American I was taught. I was taught that America is supposed to be about a promise. A promise about average folks working hard, living clean, and each generation doing a little better. But that America is being lost, and you know it as well as I do. Yes, it's easy to get cynical. All you have to do is have your eyes open. But those of us who care about freedom can't afford to be cynical. Those of us who care have to fight. Because freedom can never be freedom for the few at the expense of the many. Freedom, political freedom, is built upon and preserved by equality, not absolute equality, but that relative equality of common citizens sharing an equal voice in how things are run and for whose benefits. That's the America I was taught. 50 years ago, we got on a bus together. We went to jail together. Some of us lost our lives. 50 years ago, struggling together, we won some freedom for America. But today, that freedom is threatened once again. This time, the issue is not race, but a new class of the wealthy few, some of whom want to rule the rest of us as if they were princes or kings, rule us without our active consent. So, it's time to get on the bus again, a bus called freedom. We, the people, must demand of the wealthy what some of them don't want to do, and that is to join with the rest of us and fight for the future of America that belongs to all of its citizens. And that means, yes, that means new taxation policies. Taxes will have to rise on those most able to afford it. It's not that hard. Capital gains needs to be taxed as income. Boy, there's a big bite. And a new financial transaction tax, the so-called Tobin tax, will help tame the speculative frenzy now possessing Wall Street. Now, I want to go for just a minute. I'm getting close to the end. I want to go for just a minute into more detail concerning this financial transaction tax. What is it? It is this. In 2011, 95% of those trading on crude oil futures, 95% trading on crude oil futures, were day traders. That's pure speculation. Pure speculation. What does that speculation cost the rest of us? The average cost of extracting a barrel of oil in the world today is $11. By the time that oil gets to the market, it costs about $100. That's a lot of paper barrels chasing other paper barrels around and making big-time profits in the process. And those speculative private profits are paid for by the rest of us every time we go to the pump. So this is what I think we ought to do. A financial transaction tax will return some of that speculative profit to public purposes. The well-being of Wall Street and the well-being of Main Street must be harnessed together, not traveling towards separate and different destinies. It is time to reinvent the way of life promised in America, because that is the moral meaning of America. And there is no America worth honoring without that meaning. I'm at the end of the story of me becoming me. It's a story that began in privilege and the education offered to the privileged folks like me, an education that left us strangely ignorant. I was lucky. I got on a bus and got a second education, and it changed my life. I don't know about your unchosen lives or your unchosen education. What I do know is this. 50 years ago here in America, black and white together, we got on a bus together. 50 years ago, we sat down at lunch counters together. 50 years ago, we marched on the streets together. We went to jail together 50 years ago. 50 years ago, we put our dreams together. We put our futures together. And we won some freedom for America. Well, it's time to get in a bus again. It's a bus called freedom. And its destination is a nation of the people, by the people, and for all of the people. That bus is right out there, waiting for us. Thank you.
I think we have a few minutes if there are any questions of either of our guests. None from the audience. I have one. I'd like to ask John, if you would you describe what it was like in that waiting room in Little Rock on July 10, 1961, specifically? Frightening?
Yes, it was terrifying.
I was
a spoiled white boy. And this was not supposed to be happening to my kind.
give us some graphics.
Well, it was a waiting room, and it was filled with people, and there were cameras there, and there were police there, and there were the four of us there. And the police chief told us to leave. And we didn't leave. He said, if you don't leave, I'm going to arrest you. We stayed there. He did arrest us, and the white mob cheered and clapped and so on. I don't know whether he did that because he had political ambitions, or perhaps, because there is some evidence that we learned later, that he had misestimated the crowd that was going to gather. He had misestimated the danger that the four of us, five of us, was going to face. Much of that crowd came in the cars at the last minute. And I think it could be that he thought, if I don't arrest these folks and get them out of here, they're going to get beat. I don't know that that's the case. But was I frightened? Oh, yes. I'm not dumb.
There are questions from the audience. Yes, ma'am.
Well, pretty much along that line, I wanted to ask about your experience.
That was dangerous. Shreveport was a very mean town, very violent town. Bobby Kennedy, who was the attorney general at the time, had learned earlier on previous freedom rides that he couldn't trust the southern governors to keep their word. So
He got federal marshals to ride with us on the bus once we left Little Rock, heading for Shreveport. And he ringed the bus station in Shreveport with federal marshals. Now that endangered the purpose of our program, because the purpose of the Freedom Rides was not simply to test the segregated waiting rooms. It was to induce black Baptist preachers to come and join us in those white waiting rooms and make a statement, because the future of the civil rights movement was in the hands of those black preachers of the South. That's clear. And so we hoped that they would come into the white waiting room with us, sit down, and get arrested, and make that step forward. Well, with the marshals there, nobody could get in. And we had to leave that cordon of marshals to go out to the cars that would take us to the black community, which was the only community where we'd be safe. Well, we got outside that cordon, maybe a block or so, and suddenly there were 10 very large, very angry white guys, and they blocked our way. They were going to seriously injure us. But a local television camera person — they didn't have portable television cameras back then, they had a Bolex camera, just a regular 16mm camera — he stepped between us and those men and went down their faces with that camera. Back then, people were new to cameras and faces. I mean, they didn't know enough, those white guys, to grab the camera and then grab us. They stepped back, gave us a chance to get out of there, get in the cars, and get on out of town. In fact, the local person who received us, David Dennis, a stick guy, felt that the town had become so dangerous that we could not stay in Shreveport. And we caught a late or an early morning bus on to Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Now, that's what happened in Shreveport. We don't know. We don't know. I saw Bliss Ann Malone. She lives in Chicago. I saw her about a month ago, and we had a chance to talk. Annie Lupkin was a high school student, and although we start out as 5 Freedom Riders, only 4 of us went into the waiting room. She didn't go in, and so she wasn't arrested. Now, I think Annie Lupkin, we've been looking for her. I know the Elf for Show looked for her. I know the folks in Arkansas, you know, looked for her, and we just haven't been able to find her at all. She was outside on a telephone talking to the people back here in St. Louis, telling them what was going on. That was her assigned role. I don't know. I don't know how Jim Farmer... It was a mimeograph letter. You know, I was going out, I assumed, to hundreds, if not thousands, of folks. Maybe because I was a minister. Obviously, I was white. He wanted a white guy to get on the bus. I filled out the mimeograph letter and sent it back, and didn't think I'd ever hear from him again. And sure enough, I got a phone call. On the other end of that phone was that deep voice. I mean, Jim Farmer really had a fantastic voice. And he said, "Rains, I want you." Naive, dumb guy that I was, I said, "Okay, sure, I'll come." No! The smartest thing I ever did, and I didn't decide to do it.
My last question is, how did you feel about...
I have not seen that film, I'm sorry. Yeah. My one chance to see Jim was in Washington, and that was maybe 3 or 4 years after the Freedom Rides. Thank you very much.
We have a token of our appreciation here.
Get it in your bag.
You had Rachel mail stuff back to you.
Yeah, yeah, here you go.
Thank you. Thanks again. Thanks.